Senate Judiciary Committee will please come to order. The Secretary call the roll.
Senator Rhodey?
Present.
Senator Page?
Here.
Senator Halford?
Here.
I'd like to bring up at this time for consideration by the committee Senate Bill 29. Actually, it would substitute for Senate Bill 29 from the Hess Committee. The bill is sponsored by Senator Fakes and a number of members of the Senate. Senator Fakes, as a courtesy, would you like to provide the committee with an overview or explanation of the bill?
Under current law, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What Senate Bill 29 does is enlarge the class of individuals that may seek under the domestic violence statutes relief to include parents, grandparents, and children. Presently, the domestic violence remedies are limited to spouses, former spouses, and members of the social unit who live together. The importance of expanding this class is to allow persons who are often the victims of domestic violence an opportunity to file petitions for injunctive relief under AS 2535010 and emergency injunctive relief under 2535020. Both remedies greatly aid a victim against further infliction of domestic violence. Under both forms of injunctions, the court may issue any order it determines to be necessary to protection of the health, safety, and welfare of the petitioner or of a minor child in the care of the petitioner. What's occurring is that children are living in one home, they'll go visit another parent, and that's where they're abused, and they can't get injunctive relief because they're not actually domiciled in that residence. And the elderly, the evidence so far has shown that sons and grandsons are going to the place of residence of the grandparent or the elderly person and committing some kind of domestic violence on that person, and yet they cannot seek relief through the court system to restrain the respondent. So I feel this bill closes a loophole. It allows the arm of the court, the protection of the court, to expand to those three areas, the parents, grandparents, and children, where they are not exactly living under the same roof.
Are there any questions, members of the committee? If not, from the Department of Law, would Lisa Nelson or, Gail is Gail? Lisa, would you please join us? I presume Gail is not with us today.
That's correct.
On behalf of the Attorney General, could you give us the opinion of the Department of Law?
Just that we don't have any problems with this bill at all, and this will be fine. I have no amendments, no comments other than that. My name is Lisa Nelson, Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law.
Any questions from members of the committee or the Assistant Attorney General? If not, thank you very much, Lisa. There are several people who have signed up to testify. Senator Fakes?
For the committee's reference, Senator Rhodey, what we did during the interim is identify about 9 or 11 possible pieces of legislation to move on closing particular loopholes that existed in the statute on this particular issue. One of them has already passed this, and I targeted 3 of them that had little or no fiscal impact, who were targeting loopholes in the statutes or closing gaps that we saw that were identifiable, and this is the second of those bills. So we worked with the Council of Domestic Violence, Department of Public Safety, the Attorney General's Office, everybody that we could during the interim to work out any problems prior to coming to the legislative session.
For several people that have signed up to testify, I'd like to call them up, Martin. From the Alaska Network of Domestic Violence, Mark Ojik. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did. Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Margo Dick, and I'm the coordinator for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which is a nonprofit corporation representing 20 domestic violence and sexual assault programs statewide. We support committee substitute for Senate Bill 29 to change the definition of domestic violence in the existing statute. You have before you a position paper that we have distributed among you, and basically, not in quite as much detail, but it outlines similar things to what Senator Fakes has just said. We had one concern that was addressed in Senate Hess, and that was that the wording be included in AS 1225030B. And I just want to say that we really do urge the passage of this bill. So, thank you. Do you have any questions?
Any questions from members of the committee? If not, thank you. Next, I would like to call Barbara Nicholas from the Council for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
My name is Barbara Nicholas, and I'm Director for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And we're located in the Department of Public Safety. The Council is a seven-member body that coordinates and provides services for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. As Senator Fakes has already said, we worked with the senator in the interim to develop some legislation that we thought was really important, and this is one of the pieces of legislation, and we support the legislation. I would just like to add, because most of it's already been covered, but the need for this legislation came to our attention probably about a year and a half ago, and the Council had sponsored a statewide teleconference in which we heard from people all over the state about concerns with domestic violence, and one of the major issues that was not addressed at all but would be addressed through this legislation was in temporary restraining orders when it came to the elderly. And what people told us, particularly from rural areas, was that elderly, around times when they had Social Security checks or they had money or something like that, were very vulnerable to abuse by relatives. And so, but they were afraid to call the police, or they didn't want to call the police because it was a child, and so they didn't want to see that child or someone they loved go to jail, whereas they felt that the temporary restraining order would be an acceptable way of stopping the violence. And so we support this legislation, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Just one brief question for the chair. Do you foresee any different problems in rural Alaska as opposed with urban Alaska? I'm sorry, there's not a rural senator on the committee asking the question.
No, I don't see that. All I know is that it came to our attention mostly from rural areas, but I don't see any difference really between rural and urban areas. It may be in our rural areas, it may be more noticeable because the communities are smaller, but I'm sure the same problems are there in urban areas.
Any other questions from members of the committee? If not, thank you very much, Barbara. The last witness is Cherie Goh from the Alaska Women's Lobby.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cherie Goh. I represent the Alaska Women's Lobby, which in turn represents participating women's organizations and individual women around the state. And we would like to urge very much the support of Senate Bill 29, which we see as an effort to extend protection, court-ordered protection, for children and for certain elders who are abused but not living in the same home or dwelling as the abuser. We understand that since the passage of legislation to protect the elderly in 1983, there have been increasing reports of abuse of the elderly, and grandparents and parents are often the elders who are the abused and most likely to need this protection. So we feel that providing this protection through Senate Bill 29 would be an excellent idea, and we are wholly in support.
Other questions from members of the committee? If not, thank you. I would note that on line one of page two, that the Superior Court is still in place for injunctive relief. That may well change if the bill for this committee passed out. Does see final passage in the legislature, and we'll have access to district court for those injunctions, which should help speed the process up. Senator Bates. The HES committee has spent a great deal of time on this bill. Our research staff has also taken a look at it. conjunction, they're far more likely to solve the problem in that fashion.
It's really funny. They'd rather go to the courts than the police. I don't know why.
It's a good commentary on our court system. We tended to have a fair, impartial court system, and while occasional criticisms are made, the fact that the public perceives the court as fair and impartial to grant the appropriate remedies is a good commentary on our court system. Any additional questions from members of the committee? Is there a motion on this bill?
Move the bill's individual recommendation.
It has been moved to Senate Bill 29 passed from committee with individual recommendations. Is there any objection to that motion? The bill is a committee substitute. We are adopting the HES committee substitute.
Yeah.
Pardon? No. Mr. Chairman, my motion was put up this year's committee substitute.
I have the wrong bill in front of me.
Minor.
Yes.
That's fine.
My mistake. The motion is to move the Judiciary Committee substitute. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, the Judiciary Committee substitute is adopted. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, Senate Bill 29, Committee substitute Judiciary is passed from committee with individual recommendations. I would do pass. Next, I would like to bring up Senate Bill 73, an act relating to the identification of persons arrested for driving while intoxicated. Senator Booth, the prime sponsor, will you please join us, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me down at that end?
Loud and clear.
Thank you. My name is Mitchell Booth, Senator Spinard. This particular bill was requested by the law enforcement agencies. And it will force the law enforcement agencies to take photographs and fingerprints from persons arrested for DWI, negligent homicide, or assault in connection with driving accidents. As DWI and related statutes around the country are giving more meaningful penalties for repeated violators, it becomes more and more important to be able to prove in court that a particular person that particular offense on a person's criminal record printout was actually committed by that person. Fingerprints don't lie. In Alaska, where the defendants are routinely released on their own recognizance by the courts before sometimes they're even booked into jail, and that's where their fingerprints are normally taken, law enforcement officers do not normally perform these operations themselves. They can do it, however, and should be required to do it. There are people who have actually kill their victim in traffic accidents and whose names are not in either the state or federal criminal records simply because they were not arrested at the scene of the crime or the accident and were later brought into court voluntarily without being fingerprinted or arrested. I'm in favor. This bill started off in the State Affairs, and I'm the private sponsor, of course, and I do approve of the committee substitute drafted by the State Affairs. It makes a change as to the number of fingerprint sets and the place to which they are sent. The committee substitute states that two sets of fingerprints, along with the information pertaining to the subject arrest, be sent to the Alaska State Troopers Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory. Now, the FBI, in many, many cases, do not receive or will not accept fingerprints from local agencies, whereas they will by state agencies. So we changed the committee substitute sets states that two sets will be given. Two sets of fingerprints will be handled by the state troopers, and they in turn will send it to the FBI for any further action on that. Public safety has positioned themselves as supporting this effort, and there is a fiscal note of a one-time cost of about $35,000 for the cameras and film, and for those places that do not have cameras and things to take care of. Now, 10 of the Alaska State Trooper posts throughout the states do not have immediate access to booking facilities for which operate under procedures dictated by the court system. These locations are in Well, there are 10 of them. Each of these locations would require a $2,500 camera capable of taking pictures of the quantity necessary to ascertain certain quantity for booking purposes, etc. It's a minimal cost throughout the state. As I said, there is, for the state troopers, a $30,000 fiscal note on it. There's also, from the Department of Public Safety, a $5,000 fiscal note, so it's about $35,000. The passage of this legislation will enhance the effective use of AFM, the fingerprint organizations, and will increase the number of arrests in both the misdemeanors and felony cases. I think that that probably concludes my testimony. If there are any questions from the beginning committee, I think please answer them.
Brief question, Senator. You don't feel there will be a problem in rural Alaska, for example, someone who is hooked up in immediately where there are relatively minimal facilities?
No, because they normally, in a case of that, they send them in and they will have to take some other type, but I think that particular area would be minimal in its effectiveness.
Obviously, the percentage is very small there.
Yes, it is, but the public safety has requested this. The state troopers have, the police have. I don't take any real pride of authorship, Mr. Chairman. And I'm pleased to assist in it.
Senator Bates.
Mr. Chairman, could we have the Senator go over one more time why the FBI was taken out of the bill and the CS? Because I thought we had heard when we passed the Board of Governors for the law, the lawyers, that the FBI will not check fingerprints unless they have been specifically told to through a state statute.
That is what the committee was told, that they had to be specifically, had to be some specific authorization for that.
May I?
Yes.
The Section B of this proposed legislation requires that all law enforcement agencies forward a copy of the fingerprinting cards to the FBI. The FBI will not accept these cards directly from all local law enforcement agencies. They should be forwarded through the Department of Safety, and the wording the following wording is changed, is suggested that shall forward two sets of fingerprints and information concerning the subject's arrest to the Alaska State Trooper Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory. Now, the difference in it is originally the law enforcement agency was to send a set of the fingerprints and information to the FBI. Now, the Department of Safety has suggested this language change to do two sets because sometimes they don't send that set or they don't accept a set from a local enforcement agency, unlike the troopers or the state.
I'm not sure that answers Senator Fake's question. It's difficult for you to respond because this relates to a bill we discussed several weeks ago. Senator Fake's, my judgment is that the FBI requires specific authorization to scan fingerprints for applicants, but this goes directly into their data bank, in which case that they already have existing agreement with the state troopers.
Yes, they will not accept these cards directly from all the local law enforcement agencies, and that's the reason for the two sets going to the state troopers, and then we're sure we're getting coverage and the information the state needs to prosecute on an immediate basis, if you will.
And this goes to the other, they were doing a search for... No, they have it. They have an existing agreement now. Mr. Bruce, are you familiar with the agreement between the state troopers and the FBI, the federal computer system? They do have one. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Basically, the reason they don't take it from all law enforcement agencies, as I recall, is because there are certain standards that one has to maintain in order to become part of the system. The FBI won't. They have to meet certain criteria before you can actually come up with a standard where you do the interexchange. And the Department of Public Safety has that, of course, in some local agencies, but not all.
Are there any further questions from members of the committee to the sponsor? If not, thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
I'd like to call next to Attorney General Nelson.
First, want to register our support for the bill. It will help in certain circumstances where people are summoned in, for example, and there are no fingerprints obtained. I'd also like to comment just on the first language there on lines 10 through 13. morning, I looked at it and had a concern at first, where it says, when a person is arrested for an offense committed while that person was operating a motor vehicle, and the arresting officer has probable cause for cause to believe that the person was in violation of 28.503, which is the drunk driving, I was thinking, well, isn't it just that we were trying to get the DWIs, and why doesn't it just say, when a person is arrested for driving while intoxicated, then they must give the fingerprints? But just want to make clear that what they're also trying to cover here is situations where you have a negligent homicide, for example, and they're arrested for that, but then they're not arrested for DWI, that there just was probable cause for them to believe that the person was drinking, but they just didn't arrest them for that. So then, therefore, you get the fingerprints in something like that, or an assault in a driving case. So that's why that language reads that way.
Senator Banks.
Mr. Chairman, you can't get fingerprinted for running a red light now, can you, under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fakes, you cannot be arrested for running a red light. So then here we have arrested for an offense committed.
Oh, all right. It has to be an offense that arrest was triggered is the key word there.
Yes, and that's a violation. It's not a, not a misdemeanor.
I understand.
Are there any further questions from Representative? If not, thank you very much. An additional reason for the bill, as we seek to control those people who are multiple offenders in the area of drunk driving or negligent driving of some sort, this provides an additional tool for law enforcement to keep those people off the road of those fatalities that occur on the road. Approximately 70 to 80% are alcohol related. Many of the people are repeat offenders. And the bill may well have long-term uses there to the extent that that we can do this. It's not a perfect system. Are there any additional questions with regard to this bill? If there are no additional questions, do I hear a motion with regard to Senate Bill 73? Senator Halpern. We move the Senate Bill 73 to be substituted from State Affairs, passed from committee with individual recommendation. Any objection? Hearing no objection, the bill is passed from committee. I wouldn't go so far as to say that. It appears almost certain to pass the Senate, other than the hefty fiscal note.
Maybe I'll take a second look at it.
On the theory that if it's too easy, there must be something wrong with it.
I didn't know.
The horse's mouth. Next, I would like to bring up Committee Substitute for House Bill 157. The revisor's bill. Pardon, please. I'd like to call David Deardorff, revisor of statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Deardorff, revisor of statutes in the Legal Services Division of the Legislative Affairs. I hope that staff has provided each of you a copy of the memorandum that was sent over after the bill passed the House, which is basically a factual analysis, because without it, it takes a while to go through the bill. The bill, at this point, I think is clean. It's safe for me to say on record that it contains no substantive changes that weren't intended. that seriously, there are no substantive changes in the bill other than the repeal of substantive law that is no longer of any usefulness to the state of Alaska. The House Judiciary Committee made a few changes. We took out a couple of sections that were a little bit controversial. There was a policy question involved, and they felt those questions of choosing between conflicting statutes, for example, would be best considered by a substantive committee in that area. So they asked the House Resources Committee to look at one of them, and I can't remember where the other one went. But we took them out of this bill, so it would be as much a housekeeping bill as humanly possible. The floor amendment was something that was caught after it left committee. committee simply to avoid an unintended result. It was a section that deals with the after effects of the successful initiative. We made an effort in this bill to clean out obsolete references to either chapters in Title 42 or chapters in Title 2 that were repealed by the initiative. And in one of those instances, I believe it's section 10 of the bill, for your information, section 10, page 3, lines 22 and 23. That relates to the Dalton Highway. And we had initially just proposed repealing that paragraph. And Representative Maroon pointed out that by doing that, we might make it impossible for people to get a van load of furniture up there. And this has to do with the duty to keep the road open in winter. They used to have to keep it open for a common carrier who was regulated. Well, we're going to have common carriers regulated or not. And they still need to get their loads of goods to people who own the property in their truck. So this just eliminates the reference to the obsolete provisions on regulation. That's the extent of the house changes. If you have any questions about particular sections, I'd be happy to answer them.
Does the committee have questions with regard to the changes proposed? This is the first time the revised bill has been brought up, and it's not my intention to pass it out today. I think it's better to err on the side of conservatism with the revisers bill, because every now and then, Mr. Advisor, as you know, someone will raise a question of whether a matter is substantive or whether it's not substantive and technical in nature. And those of us that are members of the bar occasionally get the stinging criticism from those members of the legislature who are not members of the bar that in some way this is altering the progress of the legislature. So I think it's better to err on the side of being very conservative in how the bill is moved and in making sure that the members of the committee are familiar with the changes that are made, not necessarily the language changes as much as the subject of the changes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it might interest you to know that because of my experience starting with my first revisor's bill, which took two sessions to pass, I decided last summer that the best way to do this is to work closely with the Department of Law and the court system and other people that are affected by the provisions in the bill, and also to solicit from other people in state government suggestions for inclusion in the bill. So the bill that was introduced represented a consensus at that point with a lot of people. It was not just the revisor working in his or her ivory tower. It was a lot of interaction with other attorneys in state government. And that saved us a lot of time and trouble. I appreciated their help very much in this process.
Senator Kelly,
is there a relationship between the Code Revision Commission and the revised statute?
None that I know of. No, the question.
There is, actually.
Is there?
Yeah. The staff director, by statute, of the Code Revision Commission is Billy Berry, the executive director of legal services. So our office does have a staff relationship with the Code Revision Commission. And their bills, starting early last year, 1984, Dickerson Reagan, who is the staff counsel for the commission, has been bringing the bills to me before they go before the commission at all for revision and suggestions. So we're trying to develop a pretty good interaction. And there is no relationship other than that. There's a common name in a sense, but at the staff working level, we're trying to maintain a good relationship.
This began last year, then?
Well, the staff function, the formal staff function, has always existed. I would say that in the last 3 years, the actuality has been closer in terms of the day-to-day work of the group and the drafting and coordinating that. They frequently refer matters to the revisor when they feel it's something they don't want to tackle, but it's a problem.
You have had a number of referrals in this fashion?
Projects that we have to undertake. Things that are really revisor's problems and don't require a major revision.
During our review of the Code Commission, one question was raised, whether the Code Commission could use more in-house I didn't know. I always presume there's communication, but I'm glad you have. Are there any additional questions from members of the committee this time? We'll take a couple additional minutes here. If you'll bear with us, Mr. Advisor, and go through the sectional analysis to the topics. At this point,
Chairman, in my enclosure memo or transmittal, one thing that I wanted to do earlier than this year, but I intend to do it this year with your cooperation in future years, is make this an annual affair. It used to be an annual affair, and then sort of got bogged down, and it was a biennial, at best, affair. As a result, last year's bill, for example, was twice as long as this one. Two things are working. One is if we can do this annually, we can keep them shorter. The other thing is, with the computer system, we're being more careful on current work and able to be more careful. We're also treating certain things differently than they used to. So just by virtue of the way we're doing business now, that should also shrink these in the future. So hopefully we'll get these down to the point where they're one page. I would love to see that before I retire.
How do you find these sections that need revising? You don't certainly don't go through and read every. Do they come to your attention if people are drafting bills, or?
We get them a number of ways. In fact, the reviser and the assistant reviser do sit down and read every word of the law. Dull as it may seem, we have to, well, part of it is we have to take personal pronouns out by directive of the 1982 Act. So as we replace titles, instead of just sort of doing it when we have to print a new title page, we actually are reading every word of that title and looking for personal pronouns. Now, we cheat and use the computer to make sure, but we still, even though we have the computer telling us that there are so many in these sections, we still read everything just to make sure that the computer hasn't missed them. And so in the course of the three publishing cycles that I've been involved in, my assistant and I have now read about half the words of the Alaska statutes, so we do find a lot of them that way. The others come from drafting attorneys who spot them, from the Department of Law, from a state official or employee who has to administer a law, private practitioners, judges, you name it. We get them any, all kinds of things. Members of the legislature, suggest. The bulk of them we find internally. We have a statutory command to review each title at least once every 5 years also. That is something that tends to be overlooked, but we're supposed to.
The form in which the statutes are in terms of their usefulness.
they have improved the index from what I can see. That was done before I came on board. I don't especially like this form. It's not what I'm used to. Even now that I'm used to it, I'm not convinced it's the best and most efficient or economical way to produce the statutes. Mickey is not convinced either, and one of their top people was just up here last week, and we visited about that. We have visited informally about the possibility of surveying the user group, surveying the bar, and the non-lawyers also who use the statutes to see what they like, see what they think of this present publication, what they have access to in their law library, in an easily accessible law library, so we know whether we're providing them with enough or too much additional information besides the statutes themselves. I think they're cumbersome. I don't like to have to look in two places to find the law. I like to look in one place or only two for a short period of time. There are a lot of other ways to do it.
I don't want to belabor the point, but it's a very important one to anyone who uses the statutes on a regular basis. It's extremely important here. Senator Kelly.
My understanding is they're looking at having it printed in our print shop in a way that the Mickey contract would cost somewhere around $300,000 to come up with the equipment. I should say on a one-shot basis, but it's something like a $500,000 new contract, and there are a lot of programs you can for us on our own. We wouldn't have to put any additional people on, and the distribution of them, you know, people pay Mickey for these.
It's an interesting point, but not one that's crucial to the change in the form of the statutes, but it could well tie into that. Well,
now, when you're talking about change of the form, are you talking about changing the size and the shape of the page, or are you talking about change?
That, and how the statutes are indexed and how they're packaged. They're done in titles that are put together in ring binders, all of which are difficult to use. Those people who are most knowledgeable in these matters say that there are better ways to make the statute more usable for legislators, for members of the bar, and for citizens in general. And if it wouldn't be too much of an imposition, could you provide me with some of your ideas on paper with regard to how we might process by which we might go about looking at the alternatives to the present statutory form? I suppose that is most fitting for the revisor.
Well, I obviously am aware of what Senator Kelly was talking about. Have been for a long time. In fact, it was a desire to look at that change that brought me up here, not by me, a desire by legislative counsel that brought me up here as a, I hate to say it, but consultant briefly early in 1982. And I loved this place and all its winter misery, and I figured out the way to get back up here if I could. So I'm very much aware of the desire on the part of some to make it more feasible to do. I think it is. I think there are some unanswered questions, the ones that I wasn't asked to look at as a consultant that knew existed, and I still know exist, and I know haven't been adequately addressed, but there are simple things that we looked at in-house. I came from a state that published its own statutes, and has for years, and does so very efficiently, with less state subsidy than Alaska provides, at least on a per capita basis, per user basis in the statutes, and does a good job. They've been printing theirs for years. They job out the actual printing. They have a state print shop that provides camera to copy, and then they job it out, contract it out to a commercial press, and they use a big web press, which the state doesn't have. But even so, it's a couple hundred dollars every other year there, but they have every other year session. So a couple hundred dollars a year versus $350 to $400 a year here per set.
And what do you think the distribution of these is? How many would we sell?
That's an unknown question because Mickey is very close to the chest with their circulation figures. I'll have to reach back into my memory a little bit. I think I guesstimated a minimum of 2,000 subscribers based on the bar membership, as non-lawyer subscribers in the state, and assuming about the same number of out-of-state subscribers for Alaska statutes as exists for any other states. It's fairly constant. There's so many law school libraries, there's so many multi-state practitioners, that sort of thing. Minimum of 2,000, maximum of 2,500.
What's the cost of an updated
set? Of ASAP? A cost to the state or to a private subscriber within the state of Alaska right now is $475 and probably going up next year. $550. That's a brand new set. It costs about $300 a year to maintain that set. An out-of-state subscriber pays closer to $800 for a brand new set. The out-of-state subscribers are helping Mickey out. I think that's where they're getting their profit. That is instead of data processing. I would be happy to provide Mr. Senator Rothy with just some thoughts. It would be unofficial, obviously, because I do work for a unit of the agency and do have a boss. And we don't agree on all aspects of this, but we do agree on most of the important things.
I would like to do that because it would seem to me that one of the great things we might do with the people of Alaska is make the statutes more usable.
Do you work for legislative affairs?
The revisers are within Legal Services Division. We have some statutory authority, which in the past has led some people who've occupied the office to believe they have some statutory autonomy, but that's a battle not worth fighting, so really I'm not going to want to find. But he is my boss, but he knows that I do have some statutory responsibilities independent of the operation of the agency. This is one of them.
I may just make one more request to provide the committee with your ideas regarding form the statute and then any incidental information regarding the publishing of the statutes would request to provide the committee with that. I will provide members of the committee with copies of that and we can make any decision that might be appropriate or sufficient guidance. I'm not going to move the bill this time. I'd like everybody to become familiar with it, though it is one that we should move as quickly as we can. Mr. Advisor, thank you very much for coming before the committee.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other things that members wish to talk about the committee? Hearing done, the committee is adjourned.